Welcome back, everybody, to Binnum Biz. This is Paul here. I'm here with Anthony again. How's everybody doing? Ant, how are you doing?
What's up, Paulie?
Good, man. Good. Good to be with you again virtually. We're just talking before we start a recording about doing our first in-person podcast in a couple of years. So hopefully in the next few weeks we'll be able to do that and play some music. But we got a very, very cool thing that we want to like talk about today a little bit. And that is the, I don't know if there's any Netflix aficionados out there, but there was a recent documentary on Woodstock 99 came out a few weeks back. And we've already had a conversation about it, myself and you, Ant, but we thought we would we'll sit down and talk a little bit about it on the podcast. And, you know, kind of a weird time in music and kind of, you know, I don't know if we're going to, it's interesting because I think one of the great things about doing this podcast with you is that while we agree about most things, I think that there's aspects to Woodstock 99 that we don't agree with.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is cool. And, you know, so anybody who's listening to this, if you guys have any opinions on any of the things we talk about, because the thing about this particular episode is while it's still music-based, we are going to get into the realms. There's a little bit of politics involved. There's a little bit of social. There was a whole social thing around 99 that was kind of a little bit odd and weird. It was a very weird time.
Very strange.
So definitely, you know, would love to hear people's opinions on it. But so we're going to talk a little bit about Woodstock 99. So, Ant, first off, what did you think, just as a piece of film, what did you think of the documentary?
Well, it was... You know what? Let me pause for a second because I want to say, I just need to announce this. I was going to tell you as we were recording because this is how stoked I am about this. You weren't on the episode. I wish you were, but the last episode with Matt Pelosi, the producer, or one of the last episodes. Matt contacted me the other day. He's like, dude, I have to. What'd he say? He's like, I got to give you a percentage on a session I just did.
No way.
What are you talking about? He's like, somebody reached out to me because they listened to your podcast and they came and they're from New Jersey and they came in this, like, I just booked a session today with them. We were working for like 3 hours and then the guy apparently booked more time with them. So whoever that listener is,
fair play.
That's fucking awesome. Well, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why this community exists, right? So that we can put people together. That's great.
Like, to that listener, to all you other listeners, like, that right there made me go, this is why, that is another reason why we got to keep doing this show.
Yeah. And just to, like, if you're like a new listener and you're going back listening to the older podcasts and you hear anybody on there, that you like or that you want to work with or that you want to reach out to, obviously we put the details up in the links and everything up, but also if you're feeling lazy or if you want to just like talk about them or whatever, drop us a message on Instagram and we'll put you in touch with them. You know, we have a lot of great artists on here and we're gonna have more in the next few weeks, so it's a good way to get people bringing musicians together. It's awesome.
That fucking made my week the other
day. That's great. Dude, I'm so happy. Literally, I just found out about that right now when you said it.
Yeah,
so.
That's why I wanted to surprise you with it. It's the fucking coolest thing, and there'll be more of it. So
that's great. Yeah.
All right. So back to Woodstock '99. Mm-hmm. So all right. So as a film, you know, as a documentary, I would say this. You know, the problem that I have sometimes with documentaries is that I want to go into them like it's a movie.
Okay.
So I want to be like. I want to be moved emotionally. I want to be thrilled a little bit or like a movie should do to you. So I want to escape reality. The problem with documentary is they're so about reality most of the time. So that when you're hit with that drama, you're like, oh, fuck, this was real, you know? So then it's like becomes a little overwhelming. And there were moments in this documentary where I was like, holy shit, that's what happened at yeah. this fucking music festival. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Which historically, Woodstock, especially Woodstock 69, the first one, mm-hmm. peace and love, baby. That's what it was about, peace and love, right? And that's not what showed up to this festival in 99. So,
right.
And, you know, you talked about like the political and social stuff. Like there were things, mm-hmm. how about this? There were some of the like people speaking, I guess a lot of them were maybe journalists, were mm-hmm. spinning things in a way socially that I felt was a little too simplified, and then labeling it, and I didn't know how to take it, because I was like, are they doing this because they really feel like that, or are they doing it because this documentary came out in like 2020, 2021, mm-hmm. and this is where we're at socially, and yeah. it's popular to appeal to that type of whatever you want to call it, rhetoric, you know. So anyway, to get into the details, where do you want to start from?
Well, I mean, I think like a little bit of background is always handy. I mean, so this was we can't assume that everybody is as – I didn't even realize there was a Woodstock 90. I knew there was another Woodstock after yeah. the 60s one. I thought there was only one. Like,
yeah, I remember that's
how,
99.
That's how – yeah. So 90
– I was a kid. I was a kid, and I was yeah. into those bands.
Right.
And it was a thing. I remember mm-hmm. like, oh, shit. They're doing another Woodstock?
I had no clue. Yep. I knew there was a 94 because I remember watching the video of Metallica, mm-hmm. and it was the first time they had played, and like there was huge shock because like one of them had cut their hair. I was like, oh, okay. This guy has got short hair now. That's mad. That's like how, you know, crazy music fans were in the 90s. But
yeah.
So just a little bit of background on the whole Woodstock thing. Obviously, Woodstock, the first Woodstock was 1969, upstate mm-hmm. New York. Mm-hmm. there was, you know, so many great artists that became legends. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like that is the, when you're talking about the difference between Woodstock 69 and Woodstock 99, I think that's the first one.
Absolutely.
I think there's a cultural feeling that in Woodstock 69, a lot of these artists were discovered there. They were unknown, a lot of the artists before mm-hmm. 69, and then they became discovered. Woodstock 94 and 99 intrinsically are different simply because they only had established artists. Mm-hmm. They didn't. So that was the first difference, number one. So there's been three Woodstocks, 69, 94, 99. All three were promoted by Michael Lang and John Scherr. Mm, okay. Those two guys were, I don't know how high up in the hierarchy they were for 69, but they were involved with the 69, which is made plain at the beginning of the documentary. And the whole intention between all three Woodstocks was, like you said, the intention is good music, mm-hmm. peace and love, everybody getting together to, you know, all right, we know that people are going to be taking drugs, we know that people are going to be drinking a bit too much, but we're just going to be humans and listen to music and be together and have this, like, it's almost like we're going to set up this small city for a weekend, yep. and we're going to just all have a really, really good time, and we're going to be safe, and we're going to love each other, and then we're going to not do any damage. We're just uh-huh. going to do what we want to do, be free young people, and then we're going to go home and all the rest yep. of it. Turns out, I mean, I was even as surprised as the next guy. Turns out that in the original 1969 documentary for Woodstock, which is a film that I've watched a bunch of times,
mm-hmm.
was highly, highly edited and watered down. It turns out that it was not the peace and love fest that it was shown to be. That was the postcard version of 69. There was issues.
They talk about it in this mm-hmm. documentary, right? They even show yes. footage to support that, yeah.
Yeah, and it turns out, I think somebody even died at 69, yep. Unfortunately, which is, you know.
And it was not violence. It was mostly, dehydration. It was, you know, the weather. Because it was, how many, did they say, I don't remember the, I can look it up now, but the number, did they mention the number of people that attended 69 versus, I know the number for 99, and it's crazy. I think it was like close to 400,000 people.
I don't know what the original one was.
Let's see. I'm gonna look it up.
It says this is the Wikipedia version of it, which says 400,000
for 69?
For 69.
Oh wow.
It said
early estimates. It sounds like it started at 50,000 to around 200,000, and then that was the thing. It was like they weren't able to ticket everybody. So then people started, like, they just tore down fences basically around the place, and another 200,000 people showed up. For about 400,000.
Yeah.
Okay. That's crazy. I mean, that's insane.
It's just crazy.
It's a little scary too. But I think actually it's only scary because I've watched this documentary and I saw. So that's the thing. To if anybody's listening, like 400,000 people showing up for a festival, maybe to you it doesn't faze you at all. But when you watch this documentary, you get a little nervous about people gathering like that. And not even because of like a pandemic. I'm not even thinking about the pandemic. I'm thinking about how people, if there is an order in some way, people, we lose the civilization that we've built and that we count on each other to abide by, it just falls apart.
It does. I mean, just to put it in perspective, Anthony, I was just trying to find some way of framing 400,000 people. And controversially, I thought, well, let me put it up against something that we have a recorded number for. The Battle of Gettysburg was the largest battle in U.S. history.
Okay.
There was 160,000 troops at Gettysburg.
Oh, wow.
So you're talking about more than double the amount of people. Now, I don't know if anyone's ever been to the Gettysburg battlefield. It's enormous. You have to drive. You can't walk it. You have to drive it.
Wow.
So imagine 400,000 people in one place for 3 days.
So it was actually, I think it was more like four, I think it was like 4 days.
Four days.
It was like Thursday to Sunday night when they had to, which by the way, let's just sprinkle in a little bit of a surprise, I guess.
Okay. So just to give you a perspective on that, Anthony, I was looking for something to compare the numbers to.
Okay.
So basically to give you an idea of the something that you can compare where we have a reliable number for. The Battle of Gettysburg was the largest battle on American soil, and it had 160,000 people. Now, that is considered like a huge amount of people to be in any space at any time. I don't know if you've ever been to the Gettysburg Battlefield Museum. It's
never
enormous.
Been.
You have to drive around it. It's so big that you can't walk it. Now, imagine more than double. More than double, 2.5 times the amount of people that were at Gettysburg.
It's crazy.
It's an unimaginable amount of people. It's about six standard NFL football size stadiums worth of people.
It's insane.
It's an insane number. It's crazy.
I mean, so I guess it's interesting. It's interesting to think like the difference of, because I always wondered, you know, did people travel from, how many people traveled from outside of like New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania for this? You know what I'm saying? Like, I guess it had to be a high number, right? Mm. For something like this.
I mean, because, I think people, it was so promoted. Again, like I didn't know about it at the time, but like looking at the documentary, it was so widely promoted and MTV had covered it. I mean, MTV covered it all weekend. I mean, it was probably just took over their airwaves for the entire weekend. I would say people just travel from I would say, all over the world for that event.
I guess you're right. Yeah. You know. Which, what's scary is how, so, all right, so let's get into real fast the, let's, I guess, compare the lineup, I guess, the, you know, like, who are we talking about? We have 69, you have Jimi Hendrix, The Who, I think, was there. You had, was it Jerry Garcia's band? It's Grateful Dead, right?
Grateful Dead, yeah.
Joni Mitchell, I think, was performing. So, you know, like, right there, that range of that music. Okay. And then for 99, you had, I don't know, what I noticed about the documentary is that there was blame being passed around from everybody being blamed. So like there was somebody, I think they had somebody representing MTV at the time. Yeah. Then they had journalists. Of course, they had the promoters. They had the people running the festival. And everybody that was talking was blaming the other person. And obviously, as the viewer, I took away that it's not one entity's fault. This was a perfect storm. So,
correct.
But I think the musical lineup had a little to do with it. So you had, I know that the biggest they even said it, the biggest band at the time, was, and that everybody that like, yeah, that like most crowds were coming to see was Limp Bizkit, which is crazy.
Which is like that alone is like, that's the end of the podcast. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy to it's crazy to say it like out loud and to hear it. But it's true. All right. So the other bands there were Korn, Offspring. The Roots were there, by the way.
The Roots were there, yeah.
George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars were there, right? But they were in the middle of Buck Cherry and Insane Clown Posse. Do you know what I mean? And like fucking James Brown and Jamiroquai. Like they were also there. But and DMX, right? But then you had Bush.
Yeah.
Like, you know? Like, and
yeah.
Where I just saw it. Everclear was there. Kid Rock was a big one. That's right. Metallica, Rage Against the Machine, Counting Crows, Dave Matthews Band. And you had like Alanis Morissette, Sheryl Crow.
And Jewel.
And Jewel, right?
Yeah, which we'll get to later.
Yep. Wyclef Jean was there. Fatboy Slim. Holy shit, Rusted Root was there? Wow.
Yeah. Crazy.
That's a local Jersey band.
Jeff, they're Pittsburgh, Rusted Root.
I thought they were Jersey maybe they're known for coming and playing in Jersey at that point.
Probably. They probably like New York City was their biggest, closest base, but I think they were based in Pittsburgh. But John Entwistle was there. He played solo, which is weird. I didn't even realize he had a solo career.
Me neither, yeah.
Jeff Beck. A couple of the guys in the Grateful Dead, I think, were there.
Creed was there.
Not only were Creed there, they were one of the bigger bands at the time.
At the you time,
know,
yeah,
they were. You know, 1999. Creed were a huge deal. So I guess like the point is, there were some odd bands there that were headlining, but. Just the mix, the mix of, I mean, it really shows how divergent music became after 69, you know, which is, I think that's a great legacy of 69, but I'm not sure you can have all those artists at the same festival. I really don't know about that. I think that was their first mistake, you know, I think that much. And myself and you may disagree on it, but I think that much, diversity in types of music, I just don't know if it works for me. Like, you can't have, all right, we got like at 6 p.m. we've got Korn on the main stage followed by Jewel. Like, it just doesn't work.
All right, well, that from a just a straight up obvious performance
mm-hmm.
booking perspective, forget about yeah. a festival.
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I agree with, without a doubt, mm-hmm. I agree with that. It makes no sense. And considering how they had different stages, right? They had yeah. a couple different big stages mm-hmm. that these people had to literally walk across, like, because they did it on a tarmac of an old U.S. Airfield, right?
Yeah.
Like, that they weren't using anymore, like a hangar, too. Mm-hmm. Which they used those hangars, apparently, for, like, they put stages in there, but, and then something, you gotta really watch this to get really all these details, because it's, when you start putting the pieces together, you're like, whose stupid idea was that, right?
Because it starts to look ugly, you know?
And, like, as soon as you start putting the, right? So, now, here's another big part of, all right, they hired security, but like volunteer security or something like mm-hmm. that, or very low pay security, right? Yeah. And like, you had to take a quote, I'm doing air quotes, test,
mm-hmm.
right? To be able to get passed and then get, you know, this job.
Mm-hmm.
But the test was for dummies, and you had a shirt, like a yellow shirt, I think it was, some sort of collared shirt, and then yeah. One of those necklace tag things, right? But the story was, Paul, do you remember that, like, most of these people did it just to, when they got there, take the shirt off, take the tag off, and just now be part of the concert.
Yeah, they were like hanging, oh, I'm just going to hang and take drugs and just,
yeah. Yeah. A lot of them even, like, kept their, you know, their uniform on,
mm-hmm.
but were letting people with drugs in and
yeah.
just people without being tickets part of the show, that, so. Drinking, you know, doing, yeah. So yeah. that is another huge failure.
Yeah. So, you know, you got the lineup thing, which is, look, the lineup thing, I don't think it wasn't an intentional, the whole point of it was, hey man, you know, everyone loves music. People yeah. from people who like different types of music can hang out together and have a good time, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not a, it's a very positive assumption, I think. That's a great thing yep. to think that people sure. can do that. Number two, like you said, environmental issues. It was supposed to be somewhere else, and they were,
that's right,
they weren't allowed to have it there. So they yeah. changed the venue to a tarmacked Air Force base or something, an airfield. I don't know if you've, and you know, for all our listeners, this was in upstate New York in July. It's hot.
It's hot.
It can get very hot. I don't know if anyone's ever stood on tarmac when it's hot. It literally just reflects and radiates that heat. And then let's just throw in the body heat of 400,000 people.
Oh yeah.
You know, so there, secondly, that's a huge, huge element, the environment.
Absolutely.
Security, like you said. You had guys who signed up to be security at the festival. They were given their T-shirts. They were given their security badges.
Uh-huh.
And then they just turned the T-shirts inside out, threw away the badges, and fucked off into the festival and disappeared for four yeah. days. You know, so those are the first three things. So we can see already where this is headed, you know. Now, a lot of this stuff comes to light throughout the documentary, but I mean, even just like it, imagine it. You're in the middle of summertime, you're going to a music festival. What's the biggest summer music festival in the United States right now? Probably, I would say Coachella, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Isn't it usually held in like a beautiful grassy or beachy area where there's like a, it's in California somewhere, like Orange County or something.
I think, I from what I gather, yeah, Coachella like is well run.
It's well run, but yeah. it's also beautiful. Like they've got, it's aesthetically beautiful.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I'm looking at images yeah. right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, it's really nice palm trees in the background.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is that, so what you have right there is you have Legacy. Coachella is the legacy of Woodstock 99. And what I mean by Coachella being the legacy of Woodstock 99 is what the organizers for Coachella probably do every year is they sit down and watch footage from 99 and go, let's do not that.
Yeah.
You know, let's do the opposite of that. So you have your 4-day ticket. You have your, you're going to upstate New York in the middle of July and you're going to basically stand around. So it was either, you had two environments that weekend, roasting hot tarmac.
Yep.
And then the inevitable, it's Woodstock. What's going to happen? It's going to get muddy.
Uh-huh.
It's going to get wet. It's going to get shitty. It's going to get, you know, so you have 400,000 people camping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those three elements, you know, the people that were going to it, the lineup, the diversity, which, you know, we know was done in a positive way. You've got the environment and you've got the security. All right. Here's the next thing that happened. Vendors were invited to the festival to sell their wares.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you had people who were, you know... people who were there to sell water, people who were there to sell souvenirs, people who were mm-hmm. there to sell this and that.
T-shirts.
Yeah. And the vendors paid $500 or something for their stall. You know, 500, you got a vendor's license, you could go in and you can sell whatever you want. I don't remember the exact number, but do you have it there, the price of water? The price of water
was, I think back then, I think it was like $4.
$4
for a bottle of water. So for back then, that's a lot.
I would say it's $6.
$4 to $6, yeah. For back then, that's like insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently beer was cheaper, right? Is that what the thing was, or they were equal?
They were around the same price. So, but, you know, it was in an environment where people were just, you know, not only was the water horrendously expensive. So, you know, if you go to a festival and those, I don't know how much the tickets were, Anthony.
They weren't cheap. They weren't cheap for then. That, mm-hmm. But I remember looking at the price of it, right? And I like from what they showed in the documentary, I could be wrong, but I saw like $175, $180.
That was a lot of money back then.
For the 4 days. Yeah. For back then, I'm sure that was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, this is what I say to that. I go, yeah, but you're getting all the biggest bands and artists to come here to do this. So,
yeah.
Duh. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's like it would be, you'd be talking about into the thousands now for tickets like that.
You really think so? I think inflation would be that much, really?
I mean, look up the price of a 3-day ticket to Coachella. You know, I would say that a 3-day ticket to Coachella is over $1,000.
I mean, look at this. Let's see.
I would say easily it's over $1,000. But, you know, Coachella, you have other, it's comfortable, you got the...
No, it's like $400 something.
Oh, I'm surprised by that, so it's kind of half. All right, well, that's kind of not bad. But imagine you get to this festival, and you've paid for your ticket, and you've camped, and now you go, oh, let me just go pick up some, a 12-pack of water. Oh, that'll be $100, please. Like, what?
Yeah.
You know? You go, okay, well, I've just got here. I've just traipsed across the field with my pack and my tent. I've just set my tent up. It's really fucking hot. I'm going to go have a shower. Let's talk a little bit about the showers. I mean,
oh God, this is, I'm starting to get depressed. Just thinking about all this stuff. This is how everybody listening needs to watch. You need to watch this because I don't think we're doing a great job at like describing this. Let's just get right. Can we get right to the root of it? So let me just real fast, we got to talk about the culture then and how it's different now. So back then, and I'm a kid, right? And you're probably like a teenager or something or an older, like, so back then, like the MTV Spring Break thing was happening in those couple years there, late 90s. And what that meant was a lot of it was about being like right on the head, sexually explicit, like no innuendos.
Girls gone wild.
Flash your tits, like, and
Was that a request, Anthony, or was that a...
Yeah, please. Oh my God, dude.
My man tits.
Yeah. So that was definitely like right in this, right, you were right in the center of that.
Mm-hmm.
That might be the peak of it.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, this Woodstock 99 might have been the peak of this type of culture, right? So,
but what is that culture though? What would you consider that culture to be? So you're talking about a culture where you had Limp Bizkit, most popular band in MTV at the time. You had programs like Spring Break and Girls Gone Wild.
Real World, right?
Yeah, it was for me, and we're going to talk about this in depth. It was really the beginnings. I know we had the 80s yuppie culture, but it was really the beginnings of the toxic male thing.
It was
at the very least, it was a zenith in the 90s for
without
that type of behavior.
Without
like,
a doubt.
It was basically MTV was essentially, you had two kind of things at MTV. You had TRL, which was for what we called back then teeny boppers. And then you had late at night, you had the Spring Break and whatever else. Like you said, uber testosterone sexualized, you know. At the same time, I think late 1990s, you had a beautiful young girl from Louisiana who was in a music video.
Oh, yeah.
Dressed as a quote-unquote slutty schoolgirl.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you had Christine Aguilera writhing around in the desert. Everything was super sexualized. Everything was geared towards men. Everything was trying to appeal to, you know, that type of man. Listen to Limp Bizkit's music. Like that type of guy. That kind of.
I guess, man.
You know,
it's hard for me to say that though. It's hard for me to even say that that's the truth of that because I was young. I don't remember enough about what people were like, what adults were like. So to say that, because in all that footage,
mm-hmm.
go back and watch all that footage. Spring Break, Girls Gone Wild, The Real World, right?
Yeah.
Just go watch late 90s footage of people around people.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, like, I mean, there was a band that I used to play with, a cover band I used to play with, and these guys at the time were in their 40s. This is a bunch of years ago. And, you know, we had a pretty rowdy crowd. We're talking after the gig. I was like, this is a pretty rowdy fucking crowd. And these guys were like, we got to be honest with you. This is nothing compared to what it was like in the 90s.
Wow.
And I was like, tell me more. What do you mean? Because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't like piece it together, right?
Sure.
And then they basically were like this. To sum it up for you, imagine you're playing on stage and there's a woman blowing a dude. Just like he's leaned up against the stage and she's just straight up blowing him. Like out in the open, right? And I go, holy shit, for real? He's like, yeah, and that was normal. Like, that stuff was normal then. Mm. So, this was men and women taking part in this type of thing. So, this was wanted, right? Mm-hmm. This was wanted. Like, this type of lifestyle was sought out, right? And people clearly got off behaving like that. So, whether it was geared towards straight up towards men is like, it's like saying, well, what if women were into that versus women being expected to be into that? And I think that's probably where you're coming from.
Well, what I'm coming from is like what pop culture, I think pop culture really is the rudder for how certain parts of society behave, and usually the pop culture determines how. This is what I would say, and let me know if you agree with this, Anthony.
Sure.
Pop culture determines what people between the age of 18 and 35 at that time behave like. Okay. Like they take their lead from that. Okay. So you could even go a bit younger. I would say maybe even 16 to 30. Pop okay. culture at the time really is a rudder for here's how we're behaving right now.
Sure.
You know?
Okay.
Here's where our society is right now. American Pie. Guess what year American Pie came out?
99.
The movie, 1999. I mean, I thought American Pie was hilarious the first time I saw it. I did. I mean, I'll put my hand up and I'll say, look, it was a genius idea. It was a genius movie. It introduced the world in a large scale to Eugene Levy, who's brilliant.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But it's enormously problematic looking back on that movie right now. I mean, you watch it right now, it's massively problematic. There's so much in there that's just wrong from both sides. From both sides. I mean, there's the obvious stuff, you know, the obvious stuff of the guys sitting around their computer watching
porn.
Watching her undress, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so there was that. There was the apple pie thing, which, yeah, I mean, yeah. I know what the context was, but it really was like, that is very, very objectifying to women to be, you know.
What's that?
But put your finger in an apple pie and that's what a woman feels like. I mean, that's like, that's crazy.
Yeah,
like,
that's the joke. Like,
it is.
But what fucking idiot believes that?
Exactly.
And that's the joke.
Do you know what idiots believe that? The idiots that were at Woodstock 99.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, but and by the way, this is like, mm-hmm. I think you can always like reduce it to, I think it's fair to reduce it to, mm-hmm. this is a guy who's playing a teenager.
Yeah. But do you know what?
In the 90s, like of course, back then, modern day. And these are the mm-hmm. things that, I mean, as a horny teenager that I was, you know what I'm saying? Like it's inescapable.
Mm-hmm.
Those hormonal feelings. Like you can't run from them. Right. Yeah. So you get imaginative, especially when you start seeing girls around you that you like. I mean,
But listen to how much, how culturally that movie affect. I mean, as far as I can remember, that movie invented the term MILF.
Could be right.
That's probably in the dictionary now.
I
don't know if it is, but
that'd be so funny. Scholar in the future, going through our language. What is MILF?
MILF. But it's like, and that leads you to the most, because we think about the whole watching the girl undress thing and the apple pie thing and like the plot was basically they had to lose their virginity before they left high school. That was the plan.
Yeah.
But the most problematic relationship of the whole thing is the relationship between the MILF and the teenage boy. Thinking back on it now, like it was statutory rape in a movie. But and the thing is, the reason that I'm bringing up apple pie is not to say that everybody that was at Woodstock 99, if you were a dude, was a horny animal. What I'm talking about is, like, that was pop culture. That was a pop culture movie, and pop culture is the rudder for what's going on. So basically what you're saying is, here's what's acceptable as entertainment right now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I'm bringing it up. I'm not bashing, like, guys back then. I'm not saying
I know. That's why it's tough to, I'm trying to break it apart.
Yeah.
And then without, because you can't label it. Brushstroke it. It's so complex, and I think it's every piece that they said, the promoters, the organizers, whatever, the MTV or which represented the media, and then the music, the bands, right, the artists, right, mm-hmm. and then people, and I think that's the larger part of it. Like, well, people are fucking people, man.
Yeah.
And only people are responsible for people, right? Mm-hmm. For themselves, right?
Yeah.
So it was a perfect storm.
A perfect storm, absolutely.
The, if that music, I will say this, if that music were different, if it were all R&B, might have went differently. might have had a different demographic,
yeah,
or a larger demographic in one way, and a less of one specific demographic in another way. Yeah, for sure.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I also think it goes to, you know, maybe if they had a bit more reggae on the bill, it would have been probably good. You know.
Yeah.
You know, that's the other thing. Like, the big drug at the time was, I mean, that was the beginning of meth, right? I mean, that
was
the late '90s. I believe it was. Meth and heroin were,
that's crazy,
ravaging, you know, middle America at the time. I believe, you know, and if it wasn't that, it was ecstasy. You know, they could all have done with a lot more ecstasy at Woodstock 99.
I remember it during the, they talked about too, because we're the reason why we're kind of soloing in on men as like the culprit to, you know, to why this shit went crazy. Mm-hmm. But like they try to sort of pin it to like white males, 18 to 35, right?
Sure.
In the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why. I understand. I get it, right? But they talked about the anger.
Yeah.
At this time, that, mm-hmm. but they're saying it like it's truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
These journalists, but like they didn't, they made it as like, what are these people? What do these men have to be angry about? And the only thing that they kind of came up with was that the 90s started. You know, you had like grunge pretty much started the 90s, and you had really good music, and then towards the late, as soon as we got past the mid '90s, MTV started like really pushing these boy bands, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And this was the anger against that.
Yeah.
Like there was a huge population of especially dudes who fucking hated MTV for that too, because it. And I remember as a boy having that music shoved in my face,
and we didn't like it. I mean, I wasn't a fan of boy bands. I
like it
was,
now. I yeah, like I some do. Of I that love shit it. Yeah. Now, man. Yeah. But
it's great. Well, it's. I mean, I think it's also, you know, it harkens back to a time where great songs were great songs, and great songs made it, and bad songs didn't. But I think there was that. I think you're so right. There was that anger, but there was also zero outlet for it. Back in 69, they had the hippie movement.
Yeah.
They had the protests in Chicago against and Washington against Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That whole thing was starting to bubble, basically. That whole culture was beginning to bubble. So they had a direct outlet for there. If this was to happen now, you know, if that anger was to bubble now, we could direct it at, you know, neo-fascism and white supremacists, and that would be the fight. You know, the protests last year were all, you know, pro Black Lives Matter, you know, a positive fight where I'm pissed off, but I'm pissed off for a reason, and you had somewhere to put your energy. Now, you may not necessarily be pissed off at cops, you know, beating up on Black people for no reason, just the same way as the guys that attacked the Capitol this year.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they may not have been pissed off at Joe Biden. They may not have been pissed off at, you know, people, Kamala Harris. They may not be pissed off at Democrats at large. They're just pissed off.
They're just pissed off, yep.
And they want something to do with their pissed off energy, which every single era, every single culture has a bunch of people who are on the wrong side of what's happening at the time.
Yeah, and rage.
Yeah, yep. And the thing about it is that if Woodstock 99 had happened in October 2001, very different story. Because they would have had something. They would have had a pilot light. They would have had something to rally around. Back in 1990, they had nothing.
I think going back to those dudes I played in a band with, cover band with, I mean, they mentioned that in that same conversation, they said it all changed after September 11th. It completely changed. Because, and I was like, for real? They were like, the gigging scene was dead for a while. And it was because nobody had the energy to celebrate and go have drinks and go woohoo. Like, it was dead. And I think you're right. I think that you know, 9/11 really got us to focus and stop and reflect something. Because we all did, even me as a 13-year-old kid. And then now life is different. You go on, life is different. I think the timing of that it's crazy to say it, but like, how far would that culture have gone?
It's scary to think. The way that I think about it is, I look at the Premier League in England, who's some of those teams, their fans are notorious for their violence at games. Yet when there's an England match, those guys that are fighting each other on Saturday, when there's an England game, they're all on the same side. So you're basically giving somebody a team to be on. And I think that's what happened in the late 90s. These guys, you know, and I mean, just for clarity, like, neither myself, well, I can only speak for myself. I am not saying that this is white men, all white men.
Of course.
In the late 90s. I mean, that's definitely not. This is not a white man bashing session here at all.
This is
we're just talking about facts. That's what it comes to. That's when I was watching the documentary. I was thinking about, hang on a minute, what was happening in the 90s? You had, you know, Bush Senior, and then you had Clinton. Okay, you know, those guys. You know, looking at the hypersexuality of it all. You know, those guys weren't. Oh, hang on a minute. Didn't one of those guys get his dick sucked by his secretary?
Yes. Like, and they touched on that in the documentary.
At the same time as American Pie and Britney and all that. Yep. So, you know, you're starting to, what happens when you're watching a documentary is you're starting to piece all these things together. So you have, I've got no team. I've got no teammates. The only team I have are the people that look like me, that listen to the same type of music as me. And who are we? Who's the other team? That's the next step. When you put on a rugby jersey or a football jersey, you have your team. You have two things that you're thinking about, your team and the team that you're playing against. And I think they were just, through the late 90s, these guys were just looking around for a team to play against. And, you know, when my opinion on it was Woodstock 99, they had the capitalist price gouging. They had the establishment. And they had, you know, people that weren't like them. People that weren't like them were black people and Asian people and women. You know, and they railed against that. They railed against property, and they railed against, which happens, you know, every single generation. There's always something that you want to protest. There's always something that you want to fight back on. And these guys just, they weren't given a flag, so they just created their own. They created their own enemy.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, my perspective is, if you were to, let's see, what was that, Generation X? Mostly?
Yeah, I would say Generation X.
Which is, they're the offspring of the baby boomers? Is that?
Yes,
sort
pretty
of,
much, yeah.
Pretty much? So, you and I have talked about this. I don't know if we've had it on a recording, but I do believe there is something to the PTSD that, you know, somebody who fought in World War II went through.
Yeah,
you can't deny it's probably the things they saw were insane, right? However, they meaning a U.S. soldier, but they won. We won. We We saved the world. I mean, that's the story.
Absolutely.
And there's that changes how a soldier comes home, I think. And we literally rebuilt our country to be. I mean, we're still in that same paradigm, like the 50s, right? How we, right? So we're still like, it's like the same timeline, I guess, if you want to say it like that, culturally, right? But that being the origin of it. So I think though, like, but you know, Vietnam vets, right? For instance, they came home and they were also hated for going to war by protesters. That's another part of it. But that war was for shit. That war was a waste. And I think it was like 50-something thousand Americans, you know, soldiers were died from that. So now if you think, a baby boomer, if their fathers fought in World War II, then their fathers are fucking heroes to them, like to the world, right? And that's the standard.
Their grandfathers were heroes to the world.
Their grandfathers.
The Generation X.
Yeah.
Grandfathers were the greatest generation. Yeah.
But I think the baby boomers specifically, the way they look at that older generation with such a fucking like regal honor. Like, and there's this thing of, and let's be honest, thus far, I would say that a baby boomer today would never reach the same type of experience and like achievement that a World War II soldier could have. I know this is, I'm coming around a bend here. Like where's he going with this? Right. So I think though, I think that you have a generation of baby boomers who will never live up to their fathers, like the men, meaning. And they look down at how, I mean, let's be honest, the further you get from what the struggle was, the further removed, the less perspective you have on why society is structured in the way that it is, why I think certain things, traditions are important. Generation X was, to me, was baby boomers were like, if they had a phrase, it was almost like they walked around with like, America's the greatest, freedom is so important, and you know, and respect what we have,
yes,
right, and what we've built, right, and Generation X it seems like they walked around with like, fuck that, and like just cause,
yeah,
fuck that, like they literally. They literally broke the walls in Woodstock 99. They tore down the walls, which had like art, beautiful art on it.
Yeah.
And they, do you remember they were interviewing a guy? It's like, he's like, yeah, man. Yeah. Like, you know, I know like people like drew on these and painted on these walls, but like, I don't know. It's fun.
do you
remember that idiot?
You know what I mean? Just like destruction was just fun.
And
mindless.
Like, there's something about going, like, I think the 50s also start, you know, the level of censorship and wholesome, right? Wholesome, right? That's fucking smothering to begin with. So I think that the 80s let loose a little bit of, hey, take a peek into like the rock star's life. Because sex, drugs, and rock and roll, man. But they weren't on the nose with it, right?
Sure.
It was like an imagery of it, but you didn't see it per se. You didn't see what it looked like. I think the 90s, like the people or that generation 90s were like, oh, I want that sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Are you kidding me? Give me that shit. And then what can we reveal a little more? Can we get a little bit more risque? Hey, fuck it. Fuck it. Who cares? Fuck it. Who cares until we get to these guys who are, and it's on camera. It's literally on camera from then. They're interviewing some woman in her 20s. Guys are walking by going, show your tits. Like, How many times did you see that in the documentary?
Dude, there was, I mean, there was a part, there was a literally a part in the documentary, and excuse the delicate ears of some listeners if you find this offensive, of like literally a woman kneeling down and three guys around her, and she's just taking their dicks out.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I mean, go back and watch it. I mean, it literally, like, she literally is kneeling on the ground, and there's three guys around her with their dicks out. Like, look.
That's crazy. I don't know how I missed that.
Look, that did not happen in 69.
You know? Oh, yeah.
But yeah. It was just viewed differently because it was free love. It was in 69, it was considered free love. What you're doing is, in 99, you're framing that against, you have to understand what you're framing it against is the pop culture at the time. You know, when you have, if you have a woman doing that in 69, you're going, it's a hippie movement, man, free love. You know, you could just love whoever you wanted. Like, you didn't have these, you know, prescribed relationships. People could, you can make love to one person and make love to the other person, and it was great. We didn't have AIDS, and we didn't have things that could, you know, you got crabs, or you got the clap, and you took a penicillin, and you went about your life, you know? You're framing it against the pop culture at the time.
Yeah.
A woman kneeling before three men in 69 looks very different to a woman kneeling before three men in 99, the year of Britney in her tiny outfit, and the three guys sitting on a computer watching a woman strip naked. Like, it's a very different vibe.
They also mentioned, you know, we should include it. Like, it's Columbine had just happened months prior. Mm-hmm. And they I think that was important to highlight. Mm-hmm. Is that's that anger. That's that, you know, something's fucked up.
It's pure anger. It's, you know, it's undiluted hatred for, you know, and you know, it's, and the thing about it is that there's another difference between, you know, and I'm part of this as well. I lump myself in on the negative side of this. So, like, you know, don't shoot me in the head for, you know what I mean, saying this. Well, there was a lot of blame. Like, kids in the late 90s were blaming a lot of people for their misfortunes, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, they learned that from their parents, you know, because boomers didn't really have to do anything. They were the children of the greatest generation. They had everything. They were born in the 50s. Like, they had everything. That you could go to work. Your dad went to work in the 50s when he came home from the war. He got his paycheck on a Friday, and he went, oh, I'll buy lunch and a house with my paycheck. Like, you know, that was the culture back then. They didn't have to deal with as much. You know, and then boomers, when they got older, they had to deal with the serial killer 70s, you know. There was more serial killers in the 70s in the United States than any other decade, I believe.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, why is it that the 70s and the 90s
were dark? The 70s and the 90s were dark. Now, I mean, the 80s, like, I there's certain words, you know, there's certain words, and it actually kind of gets really fucked up if I equate certain words with certain decades. The 50s, you had prosperity and plenty.
Okay.
The 60s, you had, you know, peace, love, music, style, you know.
Protest too, like
but positive righteous. Protest. Yeah, it was righteous goals, righteous things that, I mean, even if you were doing it because your friends were doing it, it was still a positive thing.
Sure.
Everything changed in the 70s. 70s were, and they are, I would equate the 70s to the 90s. 70s, you had serial killers, you had a lack of style, a lack of fashion, everything became brown and yellow.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was just ugly. You know, all of the cities, I mean, you name a city in the 70s and it was dangerous.
Okay.
You know, everywhere was dangerous in the 70s, you know, but still, I mean, serial killer, you had to be, it was dangerous, but you had to be pretty damn unlucky to get killed by a serial killer. I mean, the chances of you being killed by a serial killer are very small, you know. Then the 80s come. Three things that I equate with the 80s: pollution, AIDS, and greed.
Greed.
Was where greed took off.
Oh, you know? Yeah. And but like the type of greed that flaunt.
Yeah. But I'm going somewhere with this.
Okay, go ahead.
And then the 90s, you had, you know, the beginning of a real drug culture. You had economic, it started in the 80s, the economic differences between the rich and the poor just started getting so white, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like the 80s was pure grade. But the way that you have to, and then in the 2000s you had, you know, obviously the big event of the early 2000s. And one of the things that enlightened me about Woodstock 99 came just a couple of weeks ago, was after our previous Woodstock 99 conversation that we had unrecorded. Somebody who I know that's a millennial said something remarkably telling to me. It was such a seminal thing for somebody to say to me. I was blown away by it. Like, if you're a kid in the 50s, the bad stuff in the 50s, you weren't sitting there watching the Korean War on TV. You know, yeah. if you were in the 70s, like, you didn't sit down at breakfast time before you went to school eating your cereal and watch about, you know, the Son of Sam, or the, you know, your parents didn't allow you to do that. If you were in the 80s, the very mention of AIDS, and if there was a kid around, the TV was switched off. I mean, I can't hear that. But things started to change in the 90s. We watched the Gulf War on TV.
That's true.
You know, my millennial friend was 4 years of age watching TV. She watched 9/11 live on TV eating her cereal.
Yeah, I watched it. Yep.
That is those two things, watching the Gulf War and watching 9/11. Imagine you go back to the 50s, you go back to the boomers, you go back even to the 40s. You take a kid in those decades and you make them watch footage from World War II. You make them watch footage from Vietnam. You make them watch footage of somebody dying of AIDS. They're going to end up fucked up too. That is going to fuck you up. But they didn't have that. It wasn't until the 90s that we started to televise atrocities. We were televising atrocities. And that's where the PTSD for the kids in the late 90s, and now for millennials. I mean, the fact that this person, it shook me when she said it. She said, you know, millennials don't have it easy. We watched 9/11 while eating our breakfast cereal. And I was like, wow. That's a very moving thing to say. And while it's challenging sometimes to watch something like Woodstock 99, where these guys were just doing terrible, mindless, terrible things.
Yeah.
They stayed up at night watching the bombing of Baghdad like it was a TV show. Like, all this stuff was just... All this stuff is just, this is what happens.
That is a very good point. I mean, I guess also in the 90s, you had 24-hour news. I think, like, you had CNN, Fox News, stuff like that.
Cops started in the 90s?
Cops was in the 80s, right, I think.
Maybe the late 80s, yeah. But still, I mean, it was the formative years of the people who ended up, you know. So saying that, let's move on to what happened. Like, what... The sequence of events of what led to the trouble at Woodstock 99.
Yeah, this is like going to be the longest fucking... This is going to have to be at a six-part fucking podcast. All right. So, just real fast, let's just picture every guy has his shirt off,
mm-hmm.
has some sort of tattoo somewhere, has a backwards hat, mm-hmm. some terrible facial hair, earrings, you know, whatever. Yeah. Just looks like a douchebag. Right. Some spiky hair, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Frosted tips on the hair.
Like something like that. All right.
Yeah.
And then every chick is not wearing a bra,
mm-hmm.
for the most part, and is wooing, and everybody's wooing. Did you realize that?
Ooh, yeah.
Everybody is wooing. Everybody's wooing.
And not, and I was in thinking, the, like, not in the Victorian sense.
Were they
the...
wooing the whole time?
Yeah. They got wooed out.
Do you know what I'm saying? Anyway, everybody's wooing. Go ahead. Go on.
So, but I mean, so you have a number of factors. You have all of these different, you know, types of bands, these different cultures coming together, which is good, you know, or the intention was good. You had overheating. People's bodies were overheating.
Yep.
There's one segment where the guy was literally, he was up front. I think he went up front for Metallica. Remember the kid that died? His diary said, like, you know, I didn't feel great, and you know, he started
cold, right?
He literally got hypothermia from the heat. It was so hot and he was so dehydrated that he got hypothermia. His body shut down. And when you have hypothermia, your organs, one by one, shut down to defend themselves. And he was literally in a mosh pit when that started to happen.
Yeah.
So you had this, all this combining. You had like, there's a particular part of the documentary where you had like a lot of racism going on that was not helped very much by...
Yeah, but that was the DMX thing.
I know we disagree on this, but like, yeah, it was the DMX thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. We could talk about it. DMX had a song. Mm-hmm. It was like, the beat might have been like, boo, 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 mm-hmm. classic DMX thing. And he's like, I guess the rhyme would be, or the rap, the rhythm of his rap was like, da 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 da, right? And then I'm going to say the word ninja because you know what word that spoke, yes. what I mean. But it was like, he's going, da 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 da, ninja, da 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 da, ninja. And the crowd is saying that word
yeah,
like, very loudly, right, mm-hmm. perfectly in time with his rap.
Mm-hmm.
And they presented it like it was mostly a crowd of white people yelling that, basically, mm-hmm. Yelling that word. Mm-hmm. And that was... Yeah, I mean, like that, how about this? I'll leave it to this. I'll leave it like this. I'm not even going to give my opinion about, because that is a whole separate conversation. And obviously, ideally, those idiots wouldn't say that. Ideally,
it's a tale as old as time.
Yeah, about this? If you want to say the rap lyrics mm-hmm. in the privacy of your home or car, go for it. What do I give a fuck, right? But this is, it's public.
Look.
And you probably shouldn't yell that word if you're not black, you probably shouldn't yell that word out. I don't care if it's part of the music. I mean, however, education, man, and that's a whole other, and I think like education beyond school, I think like social education, mm-hmm. I just think not everybody gets it. Not everybody fucking gets that perspective. So it's unfortunate. It is unfortunate. Yeah. It doesn't make me happy at all.
No.
It really was, it was really like, it was a bummer. It was a bummer to see that in the documentary. Yeah.
What the result of it though, was, it was a sanctioning of that feeling. Is what it was. It was a sanctioning of, it's okay to say this, and it's okay to feel this way, and it's okay to be this angry about it.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. So you had, you know, the way that it was edited. Anyway, you had.
Oh, you're saying the anger in the way that DMX was commanding the crowd, like the you're talking about in the sense of like it was presented with this like. I mean, when I think of DMX, I literally mm-hmm. think that the words "suck my dick," because the amount of times he says that in some of his songs, and he's yelling it like "suck my dick," right?
Yeah, he was a real poet.
I mean, R.I.P.
Yeah, yeah.
Good. Actually, I got to be honest with you, really talented rapper, like freestyle, unbelievable. Sure. But yes, but mm-hmm. so are you saying the presentation? The context, maybe context is even a bad word, not a great word, but like they're yelling this word, they're commanded to yell this word by a black rapper in an angry way, and they were allowed to do it and it was okay.
It's hate sanctioned. Okay. So what you have, I mean, there's no other way of using that word other than in a hateful way. You can't. There's no like. There's no community of like. DMX didn't go, "Hey guys, I'm giving you permission to say this right now."
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't. That wasn't even. That wasn't what happened. Now that will be the defense. Hey, it's okay. The African American rapper on stage sanctioned this hate. Now I can say this word. Here's what happens with hate. Hate is not something you pick up and put down like a cup. You know, when you have, especially when you have an environment where there's anger because of so many different elements, there's people feeling hot and unwell and drunk and shitty. And now you have, now you're going to introduce hate, racial hate.
Yeah.
Now I've put hate into the crowd. Boom, there it is. It's hate. Now,
But you're saying it's hate just by being that word. You're saying
I just
even if it was part of the song.
I think my personal opinion on it, and I don't know, I'm not him, I wasn't in his brain, and they don't really expand on it in the documentary because he wasn't interviewed. I imagine the artist was thinking, hey, you know what? I'm going to break down racial barriers. My white brothers, let's say this word. Let's say this word together, and let's just basically dispel the negative connotations of this word by saying it together. That I think that was the intention. But what happened is the people in the crowd picked that up and they never put it down.
Okay.
Because they were like, no, I don't think from looking at that crowd, they didn't see it as we're gonna dispel the negative connotation of this word by saying it together. Different races saying it together in a community. I think that was the intention, but what ended up happening is these guys were like, it's okay to hate because the guy that I'm hating is okay with it.
No, that's where I don't understand how you get from, how are you getting in the intent of the audience at that point? Because the thing is like that song, I'm pretty sure has that said rhythmically. That's part of the song, right?
It's such a tricky thing because it's very tricky.
Those people saying that, how about this? The people who started yelling that were fans of his music.
Absolutely. 100%.
You know what I'm saying? And they're just
I agree with you 100%.
Hey, it's in the song. Bro, yeah, man, it's in the song. Let's say it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, let's say it.
A bunch of idiots, but...
Absolutely.
Okay, so... But I don't know... And they didn't show it, and there's no way of telling, but there's no way that if you're a racist, like an actual racist, if there's actual hate, ignorance is a little different. Arrogance is a complete... Ignorance and arrogance are further apart than people think.
I agree, yeah.
Right? Ignorance is like, I like this guy. He's my ninja. You know what I mean? Like some white dude saying that about... it's like... Dude, you're so stupid. Don't say that, right? Kind of thing, right? Like, that's obvious to you and I, but there are people that are so dumb and ignorant. They don't know.
Versus what you're maybe
I'm interpreting that they hate, straight out hate, right? Like, they hate that there's a black man on stage rapping right now at this festival that I paid money to see. They wouldn't be in that crowd. They wouldn't be a part of that, right?
That's not my point at all. My point is, but what I'm saying is, they picked up. It's semi what you're saying. It's like, hey, that's my ninja. I'm here with this guy. I'm here with this. We're all together. This is great. He's telling me I can say this word.
Okay.
But in a few hours, I'm going to riot, and I'm going to utilize my privilege to just walk out of here after I riot.
See that?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so then,
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You're planting.
So let's put 150,000. Like if there was, let's say 100,000 people at the DMX stage.
Yeah.
Let's say 100,000 black people were at that stage shouting that word, and then they rioted. It would have been seen. That's what I'm saying. Is they utilized? They took the hate. They utilized it. But then also utilize their privileged position as white people to not suffer the consequences of it. That's what I'm saying.
And real fast, Paul's talking about at the very like the last night of the concert that they literally, it was pretty much like evacuation, right?
It was a war zone.
Yeah. It was a war zone because not for the sake of there was like violence per se. It was more destruction. Arson. Fires being lit.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, they fucking destroyed physical property. Like all
absolutely
of it, every single piece of it.
Yeah. And when the police came, they walked onto the field and they said, that's enough now, guys. Let's all go home.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And then the SWAT teams, right, came or whatever. And they were pretty much like, all right, enough.
All right.
Okay.
All right, you scallywags. Enough. That's enough of that. And
versus imagery from that you could easily yeah. see from the 60s or
5 years before in Los Angeles.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
You know, so that's what I'm getting at.
I understand what you're talking about.
The hate that they picked up was the hate. I mean, I think it was racial hate as well. I think part of it was. I think there were, what I caught from it was looking at I saw a lot of people who were fans, but I also saw a lot of angry guys that were shouting it. I wouldn't want to assume that somebody was just because of the way that they sing a song, but what I'm saying is they took that hate, they ran with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't in one instance turn around and say, this is my brother. We're breaking down the racial barrier, then riot, and then either unconsciously or intentionally, I'm going to use my white privilege to just walk out of this field after destroying it. You know, you can't appropriate something. If you appropriate something and then you utilize your own culture to get away with something, I would consider that intrinsically and you know, marrow deep racism. It's institution. It's the greatest form. It's the biggest form of institutional racism, because you're going, no, this is my brother up here. We're the same. But knowing full well, and the guys in the documentary said it, knowing full well that if I had been black and I had been rioting, I would have been beaten off that field and put in jail for a very long time. But I wasn't. So that when you do that, I would say if it's not racism, it's definitely massive racial insensitivity.
I think that's that right there is the best way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you're indirectly taking part in racism.
Yep.
It's on the spectrum what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Might be low on the spectrum and it might be in your mind innocent, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think the idea too of the idea of privilege, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's tricky because we're that's just become part of our lexicon as yeah. a normal. Just the idea of it, the concept of it is so complex mm-hmm. that I actually think that those two words get completely misinterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
It's two words.
Mm-hmm.
To try to you're not even describing it. They're just trying to highlight the idea of it, right?
Yeah.
Those two words. Mm-hmm. It gets misinterpreted all the time. So the idea that nobody was none of the concept of white privilege then to a white person,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be like yeah. I mean that would be like yeah, you guys know about Uber, right? Or so, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, like, hey, how about Facebook, right? What?
they were, yeah. what the fuck?
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah,
and it's, unfortunately, it is something that that was in front of them and that it was yeah. around them, mm-hmm. possibly, or maybe not even in their lives, but in their country.
Yeah.
For sure. But it wasn't part of, it might have been in a book. It might sure. have been in books, that idea, at that mm-hmm. point, but it wasn't. Surely wasn't on TV. So that's why I say it's. How about this? When we're talking about, I always say, like, when we're talking about this type of racism,
mm-hmm.
I want to highlight, like, I want to make sure that, you know, if there's pain felt from an individual,
yeah,
then fucking all right then. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Then point made for sure. Cause that's real. Right? Yeah. If nobody's complaining and it's low on the spectrum
mm-hmm.
and we're just analyzing it from like, it's almost like a thing of like, that could be very fucking, that could be interpreted as so racist.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's no pain felt from individuals from it, I always say like, okay, well, we don't have to like take responsibility for that as a country.
Yeah.
We're just, that's almost like we're looking, that's that part of us that looks for problems before they happen, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's an area right there. That could be, that could be a little, you know.
Yeah, sure.
But I really don't want to jump into that unless I know somebody's hurt by it.
Yeah.
You know? Then I care. Then I really fucking care. Because, again, it's one of those, like, I can't know what hurts.
Well, I mean, I
and the degree that it hurts, I can't know.
Really. I think if I was a better person, I would be able to live this. I would like to be able to live in a world where prevention was better than cure, you know? So I think, you know, if we were all super woke, we would be able to prevent these things before they happen. But inevitably, sure. You're right. We don't. We make the wound and then we try to fix it. You know, and it would be great if we just back in the day were like, hey, no, all people are equal. You know, and then you don't have the conversation where you have 100,000 people shouting the N-word in a field. That in and of itself is not racist.
Yeah.
What's racist about it is,
yes,
I'm shouting this word, but then I know deep down that what I'm going to do later on, I'm not going to be punished for because I have the privilege of not having to live.
I don't even think that, you know. I don't think they know. That's how lucky they are.
Exactly. Exactly.
They don't even know.
And that.
There's like, no deep down. There is no deep down.
Yeah. Not even having to know that is, you know. So what we have is we have a situation where, and I think we have agreed, we have unconscious privilege going on, and that's why that bit with DMX I think was put in the documentary, was like, you're watching this, wait to see what happens later
I wish maybe somebody will disagree with me, I wish that they saved that for later,
sure,
because
and run it at the same time as they were being escorted off the property gingerly by the police.
If they would have put that a little bit later, then I would have understood what they were trying to. You're trying to plant that the way you did it. You actually did it better than the fucking documentary did, actually, the way you described it. You're planting a seed to then show a reflection of, hey, do you remember this?
Yeah.
You know, if they would have waited later in the documentary, I think I would have hit me a little harder, I think.
And I think a lot of it was also, hey, you know, my buddy is doing it, so it's okay for me to do it. Like, there's a lot of people in the area at the same time. I'm sure it was the same for the women that were there. Hey, you know what? All these girls with their tits out, I'm just taking my bra off. I think there was a lot of that. It was so many people. Yeah. It was like spring break multiplied by bajillion, you know. It was like, everybody's doing it, I'm just going to cut loose for this 4 days, I'm going to be wild for this 4 days, and you know, inevitably, as is what happens, certain people took it too far, and they,
oh my god,
you know, instead of fainting or taking too many drugs or getting too high or dancing weird, they decided the best thing to do was destroy art.
To be continued, folks.